It's Sunday, June 23rd, 2013, and this is the Retro Computing Roundtable, show 53. The RCR is the podcast about computer history, nostalgia, and collecting by computer history enthusiasts or computer history enthusiasts, and I'm today's host, and I'm David Grealish in Johns Creek, Georgia. I borrowed a really old opening there, I don't know if anyone noticed. Next we have Carrington Vanson, and he's in Toronto, Canada.
He is.
Hiyo, Carrington.
Hello, I'm doing good. How are you, David?
Good. And then we have our other regular member, Earl Evans in Portland, Oregon. Across the vast continent. Doing good,
That's
Earl?
Right. On the fruited plain. I'm good.
And next we have a special guest, co-host. It's Paul Hagstrom, and he's in Boston, Massachusetts. And so, Paul, we're going to just talk to you a few minutes before we get started with the show.
Okay.
And so let me see. So tell us a little bit about yourself. You're, I know you're Yesterbits on Twitter, and then I only just figured out that you're grouchier than thou as a normal fan of our show, right?
Grumpier.
Yes, grumpier than thou. Right.
Grumpy, grouchy.
I kind of like that.
Sorry.
No. Yeah. So I I'm in Boston. I teach at Boston University, and they give me a big office, and which I fill with.
Oh, that's where you are right now, right?
Indeed. Yes. So it's sort of chock full of sort of, you know, old vintage computers of various kinds. I kind of concentrate more on Apple probably, mm-hmm. but I don't know. Oh, go ahead.
So I know you and Carrington have known each other for a while, I believe. Right, Carrington? Or you know, I met you at Kansas Fest, actually. In
right.
No, Carrington, you met Paul before?
No.
I have left my house twice and went to Kansas Fest both times.
Okay.
Right. I've met you at Kansas Fest, I've met you.
Yes,
only
there, I think, yeah.
Oh, okay, well, I assume you guys have maybe met at the previous time, whatever. So we all met you at this
I just fest. Have that kind of face that, you know, looks like it's met a lot of people. At
right.
Speed.
But so anyway, I met Paul at the past Kansas Fest, and we're going to talk about that because the next one's coming up next month.
And so I will be there, and you suckers will not.
Well, and Paul will be there.
I will be there.
I was pointing at you two suckers.
Nah, okay. We won't be there.
Look at my fingers. I'm picking out the particular two suckers.
So Earl's going to Japan
right
for
in the eye
vacation
with that
time. And I'll be going to Walt Disney World in Halloween time for my vacation days. Lastly, I want to mention, so with Paul, me and him have been talking and about maybe trying to do an eBay podcast, and then we kind of decided not to, well, because of time constraints and other stuff. So I wanted to invite him on the show.
So you're going to sell the idea instead? Is it rare? Should I buy it now?
You should look with
Paul,
zeros in it.
You're still
not
kind
tested.
Of considering that idea, right? He's big on eBay,
Oh, well, I watch eBay, yeah.
Well, and you tweet about a lot of Apple-related auctions,
mm-hmm. yeah.
too.
Only right, the ones so that I'm not interested in, myself.
That is probably pretty wise.
So before we move into our news and the items of interest, so I wasn't on the show last time, and so I just want to, I know Earl, you and Carrington know about this, but what happened was, very last minute, my son got appendicitis, and the good news is he's fine. He's doing great, but it was... He was in the hospital for almost an entire week. So it's just one of those weird things where we thought he had just an upset stomach, you know, put him to bed, rest and some give him something for upset stomach. He couldn't keep any food down, you know, throwing up and stuff. Then by the next day, we're getting concerned, wouldn't eat anything. And then he started having a defined pain in the side. Mm. And that's when my wife said, this, you know, looked it up and this, you know, then we took him to the emergency room. So to keep the story short, but... that's what happened.
Yeah, I'm so very glad that he's doing well.
Yeah, and so obviously we're really happy, and we're particularly thankful to modern technology, science, and medicine, and the doctors. There's a really great children's hospital here in the Atlanta area, and so that's where he was taken care of, and it was fantastic as far as his treatment. At home and doing great. So what an experience. Tell his friends at school when he goes back.
Mm-hmm.
So the first news item we have is our host topic, and so basically, those watching on YouTube, if you look behind me, you can see I've tweeted about it and talked. I have an Altair clone that I bought, And I recently I interviewed Mike Douglas, is his name. He's the creator of this Altair clone. And so please give that a listen when you get a chance. So this is a this is an interesting reproduction because externally and functionally it's a reproduction. Technically, though, it's a work-alike. That's the way I sort of define it. So, for instance, Vince Briel's Altair Micro and his Replica 1, they don't try to look exactly like the real thing. They function like the real thing, so they're work-alikes. And then a guy named Grant Stockley a few years ago made an Altair reproduction, completely reproduction. And anyway, so this one is, you know, out externally, for all practical purposes, it's a real Altair. Look at it. It's great. But if you open this case up, there's nothing in it. It only weighs like 7-8 pounds. It's really funny. So what I want to discuss is, what's anyone's opinion about, what do you prefer? I mean, I would love to have a real Altair that's in beautiful condition and, you know, and I can use it and play with it and have it and stuff. But sort of, what's your feelings about reproductions versus work-alikes? Do you care? Even, that's my topic. What do you say? Anybody? Any of you own some like Vince Briel stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I think so, right? Carrington, what do you have?
I got a few things. I've got the A2 MP3 card. I think that's Vince.
Okay.
I've got.
But that's not really a reproduction, or.
It's a reproduction of.
It's like a brand new product. Yeah.
But I think it's. I don't have his replica one.
Right.
I don't have the replica. I've got replica nothing. I personally am more interested in real vintage stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't have any personal relationship with the Apple One. Never used one. Never owned one. Don't
right.
have a spare $600,000-$700,000 lying around in case the whim hits me. So, because I don't have that nostalgia connection, I don't have any draw to have an Apple One. Like, I sort of began with the Apple II. So for me, it's just all about Apple II. So I haven't really had to play in the replica world, and I've never been interested in clones as. Other than as, oh, isn't that a cool clone? But I don't want to collect a lot of stuff, so.
I got you.
So I don't really have a strong opinion either way because I don't want either of them.
Okay.
I guess I do have a replica one which I have booted up a couple of times. You know, mm-hmm. I've started it. I've hit reset. Then the original 6502 fried. And so I put a new 6502, older 6502 in, and it works again, and I've reset it again, and that's about as much as I've done with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is kind of interesting to sort of, you know, explore them, even though I started, you know, I also started with the Apple II, so I'm not, I don't have a connection to it, but except it's sort of, you know, semi-archaeological one. You know, it's kind of like interesting to see, and there's so little... there's a little out there kind of that kind of shows you what it was like. So it is, it's a little bit fun to, you can see, Mike Willigal had a video up of him sort of like getting the Selby up and running.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. You can sit there and watch whatever 30 minutes of him toggling switches and going, oh, wait, back, you know, and having to back up. And it's a, you know, it's an interesting experience to try.
Well, I mean, I guess for me, so this probably isn't for everyone because there's, and in talking to Mike Douglas, for instance, people who maybe are more hardware enthusiasts, well, maybe they'd prefer to mess around with an original one or the real thing, or at least one that reproduces the S100 bus and those intricacies of the hardware. I mean, I can't afford a real one, and actually, I never had one of these. I never had any real experience with this, but I did get to meet the guy at Roberts. I interviewed him, and that was a pretty neat experience. And so, I've just always been fascinated with the blinking lights and the switches and all that. So, for the price, I thought it was like I got to get one of these, and so I'm real happy with it. So, but I'm sure there's some people out there that because it's inside, it doesn't have a bus, and you can't put real cards in and all that. They probably don't care about it. So,
I think with something like this, it would depend on what I was going to do with it,
mm-hmm.
whether or not a reproduction or the authentic article would be more attractive to me. For instance, with something like that Altair, I would want to be entering programs and playing around with the assembly language with the switches and the lights,
mm-hmm.
just like people did when they had the real Altair.
Right.
I probably would be hesitant to do that. I've always been about playing with the vintage computers, whatever is in my collection, or the electronics. So if I had a real Altair, I would probably not want to be playing around with it. And I've talked about this before, because I would be scared I would break it, and it's so stinking expensive that breaking it has bad consequences. Whereas if I could buy a modern system like this, still play around with it from a software perspective like it was the original article, but I don't have to worry that I'm breaking a multi-$1,000 machine when I'm doing it, that would be really attractive to me. Something on the order of the Replica 1, less so, because kind of like what Carrington said, I didn't have an Apple 1 back in the day. I'm not even sure I've ever seen an Apple 1. I've seen a really good replica of one. One of the actual replicas, as opposed to the Replica 1 doesn't purport to look like an Apple 1.
Right, it's function like one.
Yeah, the replica that I saw at the Seattle Club meeting, even down to trying to get all the original chips, was, you know, a chip for chip replica, which was really cool. But not having one, I wouldn't have the nostalgia factor with that. But with the Altair clone, like is behind you, I would want to play with that thing. Mm-hmm. So for $600, I would feel comfortable playing with it.
Right. And me too. Even though it's, you know, I'm not going to probably be able to get into the doing much with the front panel. Though, it comes with a manual and some instructions. So I'm going to get to play with it some, and I'm happy for that. And plus, I can interface it to, it's neat. Remember how we got the license from, I wanted to mention that Mac program Cathode that gives you a real retro-looking terminal for your Mac. So it's perfect. Now I can use that with this Altair.
Oh, so, very cool.
But anyway, anyone has a chance, if you're interested, listen to the interview. I think it was pretty good. It's about 37 minutes. And it's a beautiful reproduction, though. I'm really happy about it. And you know, frankly, it is sort of a, most of the time it's going to probably be just an object, you know, but this is probably the most money I would spend on something like that. But I like it. It's pretty
Cool. Well, it's eye candy, if nothing else.
Yeah, the blinking lights. Can't beat them.
Yeah, and once I can get the little something going where the lights can be all, you know, changing and stuff, I can leave it like that for a while.
And it is true that, I mean, you wouldn't have access to one, you know, in real life, most likely, unless you know, when you win the lottery.
So, I mean, I haven't looked recently, but you're looking at least about $2,000, and I definitely don't have that kind of money to, you know.
Maybe somebody should go the other way. So instead of making a replica of these that is smaller and lighter, go bigger and make it with, like, Christmas tree lights and just, like, you know, fill a room.
That would be cool.
go big and cheap.
The giant 8800.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be pretty neat. And then you could make it where it's just the front panel that you mount on the wall and have multiple people switching.
It is a wall. It is your like garage door. It just comes down.
I think it'd be pretty neat. The last thing I'll say about reproduction versus work like and all that stuff is, so in my own history, though, I have two different radio reproductions, and one is a GE Cathedral radio. And I actually bought this in the 80s. You guys have probably seen these before, right? These reproduction radios. Mm-hmm. But this one was a reproduction. GE made it of the real one they made in the 1930s. So it's pretty authentic looking, even though it was a 60% reproduction. So I'm just as happy to have that because it functions versus I could maybe buy one, but I would never be able to restore it to get it to work or to do it, you know, enjoy it or anything. So I'm happy with reproductions, depending, you know. So moving right along, let's go to you, Carrington, about Steve Wozniak and the Apple Ones.
Well, remember how I just said I have no interest in Apple Ones? Well, my first news story is about
you
Apple
lied.
Ones.
You lied.
And how I said I don't care about replicates. It's all the original ones. So it was just such a crazily cool story. I found this because Dean Nichols sent the link on the K-Fest mailing list. If you're going to Kansas Fest, you really should be on that mailing list. This is just the most amazing story. So... in San Jose, the History San Jose Museum, or more specifically, the History San Jose Collection Center, decided or was convinced to boot up their Apple One to see if it works. They have an Apple One. It's one of their prize collections. And a fellow, I think it was Ralph Simpson, he convinced them to boot it up and sort of test it, see if it's working. And so word spread, as the article says, that that was going to happen. And Wendell Sandler, who you might know as basically the guy behind the Apple III, he decided to show up and bring his two. So there would be two Apple Ones. And then Alan Baum, who was a former Apple employee who also has one, he said, well, I'll come too. So that made three of them. Andy Jong, Berkeley Computer Store owner, and I think a fellow who was one of the first resellers of the Apple I, he decided to come. So that made four. They invited Woz. Of course, Waz can't keep away from this, and as Waz is heading out, he grabs his. So you've got five original Apple Ones, and it was an event that was...
I didn't know one of them was Waz's, though.
Yeah, so five of them there, one of them being Waz, and they decide to boot them all up and see what works. And of course, everybody's nervous because maybe they're about to destroy original Apple Ones. There's not a lot of those around, and they're worth a lot of money. But they did get booted. They did get tested. The article says that three out of the five were functional, but it doesn't name which two weren't. Anyway, what a crazy awesome event. There's some video of the event. We'll have a link in the show notes to the Mercury News site that's got a slideshow of the Apple One and the event, and also some video links for the event, so you can check it out. Really, really cool. If I had been in the area, it's something I definitely would have wanted to go and see. So, pretty awesome event.
It's pretty historic. I mean, obviously, the Waz was there, all these Apple Ones, but then for him to bring his Apple One?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
crazy.
A first.
Even the article says it's sort of like having Stradivari over to your house to make sure your violin's in tune. Like, damn, sorry.
Yeah.
And Waz booted them up like he was to, they said, go press, you know, boot the first one. And, yeah, so a remarkably historical gathering. I don't know if there's ever been five Apple Ones together all trying to run, you know, in the last 30 years. Like, just crazy.
The video snippets are a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
If you go over to the site, you got to watch those. I think somebody comments that one of the only Apple Ones that didn't actually function was Waz's, which was ironic.
He'll probably be able to fix it. So, yeah,
Earl, why don't you take it next then?
What have I got?
You have the Steve Jobs video from 1994.
So this has been, I guess, unearthed recently, and it's an interview that Steve Jobs was in when he was at Next. And he's talking about legacy. And I guess somebody asks him, you know, what do you think? You think you'll be remembered? And his take on it at the time was that the industry was so fast-paced, things go obsolete in 10 years, and he thought in 10 years, nobody would be talking about him. All the stuff that he was involved in the creation of or the sales of or whatever will be swept into the history waste bin, and everybody will be talking about the new thing.
Mm.
Of course, so I think there's some irony there. Of course, it didn't wind up that way. And, of course, then he had no idea that he would come back to Apple and that there would be another wave of his involvement there. But it got me thinking, too, you know, like everybody was saying, well, of course they'll remember the name Steve Jobs, along with Bill Gates and a couple of the other really
Steve
groundbreaking
Jobs.
People.
Doesn't ring a bell.
But I wonder about it, because if you... Computers are everywhere now, but if you go talk to somebody on the street today, will they have heard of Charles Babbage or Conrad Zuse or...
But they will have
Nassau
heard of Henry
Barry.
Ford, though. So you can get to a certain level where you seem to... Like, so I think Jobs is beyond Babbage in a sense.
Perhaps.
I've heard of Lady Gaga and...
But have they heard of Lady Ada? See, this is what I'm saying. Some of these people who were so instrumental in the beginnings, nobody knows their name.
Well,
but I wonder if it's just a critical mass thing that people really will remember Jobs and Waz and Gates.
I mean, like, you know, how about Ed Roberts or Lee Felsenstein? I mean, those certainly aren't, you know, anywhere near as well known. It strikes me the date of that video, though, 1994. So, obviously, this is just before Toy Story, as far as really big success for Pixar. And this is, you know, what, at least two and a half years before him coming back to Apple. And Next has failed pretty badly at that point. They stopped making hardware. They were trying to develop Next, or I guess they had for Intel, and that really wasn't going anywhere. You know, so I guess he was pretty much at a low point there, really, as far as the technology side of things, other than what Pixar was doing. I'm sure he probably felt optimistic about what Pixar was doing, but, you know, they hadn't finished it yet.
I mean, it was
so
a real humble
video.
Response.
Did you miss any of that stuff?
No. Well, the little snippet that I saw was short.
But don't you think his answer would have been different 10 years later?
I don't know. I was just struck, as always, though, by how articulate Steve Jobs was to talk to. The metaphors that he used when he was kind of explaining his answer And the guy was just, you know, a genius in thought. He kind of thought in metaphor. You got to see the video to see what I'm talking about, but not at a loss for words.
Earl has been caught up in the reality distortion field.
No, I'm not in the RDF, and I'm not, you know, what people would describe as a Jobs fanboy, but I have to say the man was super articulate and educated. So
I'm gonna Paul, because I know you you're not used to this. So you got any comments? What do you think?
Well, I haven't seen Paul. I haven't seen the video. So
we'll wait.
I saw I don't know, it was a few months ago, maybe actually it was the beginning of the year that the lost interview or whatever came out on iTunes, and it was surprisingly engaging, you know. I mean, you know, you the time flew by as you watched it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's hard for me to be, you know, I don't worship the guy by any means, but it's hard for me to be unbiased, I guess. But I have to think that even if you weren't someone that, you know, was that all that impressed with Steve Jobs, like if you watched that video, if you watched that interview and stuff, the man was pretty, you know, just said some remarkable things. And his insights about, especially that one, about like marketing and business and, you know, is really, really outstanding. Even though I've seen a number of videos, when I saw that one really stood out.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in public he doesn't act like the reports you hear of him in private.
Right.
I happen to have the Lost interview right here. You know, I haven't watched this. I saw it. I was fortunate that it came to Atlanta, you know, when it came to theaters. I got to see it. And I bought the DVD right away. So I haven't seen it a second time yet. Been meaning to. Maybe I will soon. So now moving right along, let's go to Paul. So Paul, tell us about Kansas Fest and Oz K Fest.
Yeah,
that's why you're here.
I guess right, exactly. That's
no,
the
not
that's
only.
The, but yeah, I mean, so pretty much not a week goes by when Kansas Fest is not mentioned. So presumably it's relatively well known to everybody. But it's coming up now. It's what I think it's maybe exactly a month away. When is it? It's the 20.
I guess a little less, right?
23rd to 28th.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. So, and this is what is it? It's like the 35th anniversary of the Disk 2 disk drive, and so it's things are sort of disk themed, and they've got Randy Wiginton as the keynote speaker. And there's actually, so there were some, there has been some discussion on the email list about sessions, and not so much recently, but there does seem some interest, there's interest in doing sort of disk-related things. One of the things that seems most interesting to me at the moment is the focusing on deprotecting games. There's a, you know, a couple of different, well, not games, software. Games are, you know, the way I thought of these protected things in my youth. But the problem, of course, is that so many things, they didn't want you to copy them, and the Apple II platform actually had a pretty big problem, I think, with software piracy. So, you know, I imagine. Recently, I've seen many original discs. As a child, no. I saw many, many copied discs. But so, of course, then there's this fight between, this sort of war between the content distributors and the pirates to just, you know, sort of either to keep the thing from being copied or to, you know, think of some clever way to get past the protection or protect it. And so there'll be a couple sessions talking about that sort of thing, how you maybe these days read a protected disk with hardware solutions like the CryoFlux or the Disk Ferret. And there's going to be a boot tracing session at least, various things centering on the disk too. So, but okay. it's a week, almost a week, several days of a kind of a camp-like environment where you don't sleep and everybody's interested in the stuff and actually related stuff. There was another question that came up on the list is that you don't have to be Apple II focused entirely in your life to have a good time there. I mean, because many of the people who are interested in the Apple II and are going to this are also interested in other, you know, machines of the era. So.
Okay, and you're going to be there the whole time? Like, when are you arriving?
I will. Yeah, I'm getting there actually on the morning of the first day. But
okay, a lot of people. Which is a Wednesday? Is that right?
It's a Tuesday.
And a lot, some people arrive now on Monday evenings, I guess, too.
From what I understood, actually, it start on like Wednesday or Thursday or something, and people kept coming early.
Oh, okay, Tuesday's early.
Kept backing up. But
when are you showing up, Carrington?
I'll be there on Tuesday, maybe a day early. I sort of wander. I drive down and I get lost a lot. So,
right.
Last year, I arrived, I think, late Tuesday, too late to even go to the opening dinner because I was lost or something came up. Oh, I think I ran into a friend. Ran into someone I hadn't seen in forever. That was it. Yeah, it was crazy. So we'll see. My plan right now is to get there for Tuesday morning. Maybe it'll be Monday. Who knows? But I'll be there the whole time. Can't wait. Can't wait. One of the highlights of my year.
I know. I had a great time last year. I really enjoyed it. And so maybe next year.
No, this is the last year.
How about you, Earl?
I want to go as soon as I can again. I loved Kansas Fest. It was amazing. I can't go this year just because I've got some other travel that's too nearby, in terms of too close in time. Can't take that much time off work, like in a row in July. But the next time I'm able to go, I'm there.
Excellent. All right. So, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to mention also there is a kind of a parallel meeting that's been organized in Australia called Oz K Fest, I guess, and it's happening. I think it's the 27th and 28th of July, so it's sort of the tail end of the Kansas Fest period. So people who are in that area can go, and there I think there's a plan to have a video link, and they're going to. I mean, they'll do similar things. They'll also sort of discuss what had happened in the few days, before their event that had happened at Kansas Fest. But I think the idea is that it's a sort of a similar kind of
sister or brother event. Yeah. I was going to ask you about whether the two events were going to try to do something together. It'd be neat if you could do something where you have an Apple II. Communicate with Apple II there.
World's
something.
Longest NATA net.
Right.
Actual phone cable, or actual cable right across the country, right across the world. It'd be awesome.
Well, not long ago, we had a video capture board, set up on an Apple II. I forget who did that, but it was on. It was posted on the Facebook group. So steps are made, at least in that direction.
And Paul, go ahead and mention, I guess you're participating in the Retro Challenge this year?
Yeah, well, I think it's the Retro Challenge is so there's a sort of twice a year there's a sort of like a period of time. I think it's generally what is it?
Month of January and month of July, right?
Right. Yeah, okay. That sounds right.
Okay.
When people sort of commit to do something retro related, and it's framed as a contest, but often the entries are things like use my Timex Sinclair or something like this, and basically there are no rules, and there's kind of a judging at the end, and there are people that are placed, but it's mainly just an excuse really to focus on some retro project that you've been meaning to do. I would like to participate. I have yet to narrow down a topic and find the time, but I probably will. I've signed up the last couple times and done nearly nothing.
Okay, so that's the month of July. So there'll be a link in the show notes for that too. Right.
If people are interested, you can just check it out at retrochallenge.net. So it's a pretty easy URL.
Our next show is July 7th for the RCR here, so maybe we can talk about it again, see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so moving along, so it's me, and I'm going to mention, I want to mention a new podcast. Where is it? Here it is. So a new podcast called Antic, the Atari 8-Bit Podcast. I think, I don't think Carrington cares too much. Paul,
I care.
I don't know if you care too much. I think Earl cares, and I listened and enjoyed it. So
I do.
It's our buddy Randy Kindig.
I'm interested in all vintage computer podcasts. I love when another one gets launched. So I'm very keen on it.
Yeah, and Kevin Savitz is in on this as well.
Yes, and then also Brad Arnold, who's my bud here in Atlanta. He's the president of the Atlanta Historical Computing Society. So he's in on it too. Showed out, and I just actually finished it like this morning, the last little bit of it. And so go check that out.
It's just the one episode so far, correct?
Yeah, just one. And, I don't know if they mentioned how often they're going to do it. I don't think they mentioned that.
They did say it's up on iTunes now, though, so you can search for it and subscribe to it from there.
So check that out, especially if you're an Atari fan.
And so they also have a very easy URL. It's just ataripodcast.libsyn.com. So nice, simple one.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a nice style. I think they copied us.
I think we copied many others.
So, Karen, you tell us about the Turbo Intabulator.
No, you can't make me. You're not the boss of me. Okay.
I like that name.
It is a great name.
The Turbo Intabulator.
Yeah, the Turbo Intabulator is a fantastic name. It's like something out of who's that little green fellow from Mars in the
Bush Yeah, Valley? Right.
Yeah.
Gazoo.
Yeah, not Gazoo. Jeez, that's
Marvin.
Stones.
Marvin the Martian.
Marvin the Martian, that's what I'm thinking of. That's in my brain. So anyway, the Turbo Intabulator is an interesting mix of very old technology and very new technology. It is a mechanical computer, but it's a 3D printed mechanical computer. So it's got like all the buzzwords you could possibly want. And it's pretty fantastic. It uses a punch card reader, also 3D printed. So this fellow has worked on this 3D printed punch card reader and then hooked it up to a computer, like a mechanical computer. So basically an adding machine.
Yeah.
And it's pretty spectacular. So it's got this really cool counter, and it's you know just like your typical mechanical computer. It's a little limited in what it can do, and it's not exactly working at multiple functions per second, really. It's just a click it away. But it's pretty fantastic that this person has now designed and has a fully working a mechanical computer that you can just basically print. Here's the plans, print it out, have your own mechanical computer. I'm very interested in those early things, in mechanical computers and in that sort of stuff. We brought up the Babbage word earlier. So that this kind of thing always gets me excited. And I'm also very excited about 3D printing technology, and we're at the beginning of that. And I find that an incredibly exciting technology, and amazing things are coming out of it. It's just too bad that it's so crazily expensive. But it has so much in common with early home computers in the expense and the opportunity and just the excitement about it. So I love that these two worlds have come together here. So there's a nice article over at Chris Fenton is the guy who did it. So chrisfenton.com, you can see his Turbo Intabulator. And he also has a great video online. And if you just go over to his site, we'll have a link to it in the show notes. You can see the video of the item actually working. So he documents the process, talks about how it works, and really, really interesting project. Talk about a retro computing challenge. Like, holy cow.
I'm getting more and more excited about 3D printing. I really don't know a lot about it other than seeing these sort of things done.
Earl and I were talking earlier about how we may actually replace you with a 3D printed David Grealish.
How expensive? Because cool. You mentioned it's expensive. I mean, so what, a entry-level machine is about $600-$700? Is that right?
I think much more than that.
Much more than that?
Not a lot more than that.
But then
an entry-level machine for under $1,000.
But
yeah,
then there's kind
a
of a
Kickstarter
next step
one recently
for
yeah.
a more substantial machine. Like this
what you can do
using.
With it, though, is limited, and the resolution is limited. And I
right.
think there's also either some copyright or patent wars happening in that space, too, that are resulting in your home type of 3D printer not being able, because it's encumbered by patent, to have the same resolution that you might have on a more commercial model. So
well, otherwise, you would just make more 3D printers. Wishing for wishes.
Right.
Just one really good 3D printer and you have solved this problem.
It's like building the robot that can build a robot. You're in trouble.
We're eventually going to be overcome the world in the gray goo of 3D printers.
I have wondered how much the goo costs, the stuff, that it uses to print with or whatever. How expensive is that? Real expensive, or is that part relatively cheap?
It's made of people.
Perhaps the plan is it's like the inkjet or whatever, it costs nothing to buy the machine and it'll bankrupt you trying to keep
right.
it set.
Yep, it's Soylent Green is what powers
these
people.
I've got a buddy who has one. I'll ask him. I'll find out what the price is on the consumables.
On the website, that'll be in the show notes. I thought this was interesting, a person's comment. And because they say I am a philosopher, and you'll pick up on this in this guy's comment a little bit later. He says, in the area I deal with is consciousness and free will, and I'm just enthralled with your computer because it's understandable to most people and elegant in construction. Okay, my point is that presumably a small computer can do the work of a large one, but of course take an enormous amount of time, and in a sense this computer with adjustments could do the work of a supercomputer. Cool. Then he says, I get this idea from Wolfram, but maybe I need to be corrected. My question is whether a computer can ever attain consciousness, or conversely, whether we are machines or something else. Whether we are bound by cause and effect, determinism or not. Okay.
The funny thing is, I actually convinced him to go into philosophy, so he doesn't have the free will he thinks he does.
I know he identifies himself as a philosopher. It's kind of funny that he went into that talking about this three. But okay. All right. So next up is Earl.
I guess.
Talk about the Prince of Persian source code.
Well, okay. First, giving credit where credit's due, Christopher had sent in a link to that video that I talked about earlier for Steve Jobs. I forgot to acknowledge that. So, Christopher, thank you. Likewise, Michael sent this link about the Prince of Persia source code being reviewed. This is on Fabian Sanglard's website. I don't know if you guys have had a chance to take a look at this, but this is just absolutely fascinating. You know, a while back, of course, this source code was unearthed, recovered, Jordan Mechler's source code for Prince of Persia. And this website has an in-depth inspection and analysis and review of this source code. Talks about the bootloader, for instance, how this works, goes into more depth of how the actual program works. And the level of technical analysis here is just so much fun. There's diagrams, so anyway, you take something old like this and you really deconstruct it, you can find some interesting tidbits. For instance, I guess for the bootloader, they used an 18-sector approach. Apple's default, I think, the stuff built into the ROM is 16-sector. And the fact that they had figured out how to be more efficient on these disks and make them 18-sector gave them more room to store stuff on the diskettes, but also just wreak havoc with the people who were trying to copy the program, the pirates. They had a real hard time with this. So I don't want to spoil any more of this for you guys, but take a look at it because it's a fantastic set of articles.
Yeah, I did look through that a little bit, and it does look like quite a bit of fun. And actually, it is taking a kind of a archaeological view as well. I think this is someone who's discovering it a little bit as he goes. It wasn't doing this back in the day, but it does. It covers a lot of the stuff to get the code in. So far, there's not much about the game itself, but hopefully he'll keep going.
Yeah, it's very interesting. In the bottom part of the article, the less technical stuff, it just has these videos about this animation reference showing people live action and then how they did the animation in the game.
Yeah, I think it was his brother that he used for that. Took pictures and videos of his brother going through motion originally and making the game.
So, Paul, I remember that too. But just how sort of realistic it looked like the people moved around in that game early on.
That game is an unbelievable
achievement. That stood out. So, Paul, you take
also,
it away. There's
another interesting thing here was that it sounded like Jordan Mechner actually comments on this article, too.
It says, wrong, wrong, wrong.
What are you talking about? I didn't do it that way.
Well, he did. Jordan Mechner did at least, tweet about it. Call attention to this review. So, so I guess I am next, right?
A crazy Apple II auction.
Right, it's a fairly brief thing to talk about. It's just that recently there, actually I think it was just after the last show ended, that one of the earliest Apple IIs that I've ever seen on eBay sold for $23,000. $23,000.
Wasn't it a serial number like 47 or something though?
Yeah, it's
like crazy low.
It is. I've seen pictures of some of the lower ones, but this is. I'm not surprised that it went high. I'm a little surprised that it made it that far. But it is, yeah, so it's serial number 47, and mm-hmm. it's got, they have, I hope the auction lasts for a while, actually, because it has really great pictures. It might actually be, if I can condone this, worth grabbing the pictures off of the auction before it disappears. But they've got a good picture. The motherboard, everything is clean and looks exactly like it should have. This it's interesting to see some of the little details that you look for. It's got the white 6502 chip mm-hmm. and all the memory select blocks. The power supply has a mark on it that says power supply 0049. You know, so it's very early. And actually, one other thing that was interesting about this was the if you look at the case, it's very lumpy.
They had to trim it, didn't they?
Yeah,
one of the early cases?
It really looks like it's made out of clay or something. Like if you were going to make a Play-Doh Apple II, it would also look like this.
Because I think the molding was off. They literally had to sort of like sand and saw and trim it all out and stuff, right? To make things fit.
Yeah, I'm not too... I don't really know exactly how that... Somebody had mentioned, I think it maybe was Mike McGinnis had mentioned that there was a wooden mold used for this that caused some trouble. But anyway, the pictures are great. It's really interesting to look. And also, incidentally, another Apple II Plus was sold, but I don't think that made much of a dent in the $23,000 price.
So, is this a record?
It reminds me of very recently, Twitter was a bit abuzz because the first version of Ultima was for sale by some fellow who didn't seem to know.
I froze.
No.
We're still here. Sorry.
All of us are good. I think it's Carrington.
Let's give him just a second.
It must be on his end, right? Because we're all good.
I guess so.
Carrington. Yoo-hoo.
Sorry, everyone. And we can't look at the comments because it was Carrington.
That's true.
I mean, I don't know if I should carry on with
it. Yeah,
I know
the topic. Listening, so.
So there was a guy who had listed one of the first copies of the Lord British, Ultima game. And so Ultima 1 came in a couple of different versions. And this, it came in a baggie. It had a nice colorful color art. There was a fairly short-lived release by California Pacific Computing, and then here he is, Carrington's back. Okay. Anyway, so maybe Carrington can pick it up there. I was only just sort of saying that there was this first release, and then fairly shortly after that, it was replaced by another one released with a different label on it, and they're very rare. So, but Carrington has.
Oh, Karen, we can't hear you.
We can't hear him, though. Okay.
You might need to check your settings and hang out.
Oh, now we hear you.
Yes.
Google sucks. Is that Google?
Yeah.
The NSA hears you, too.
They suck, too.
Bring it. I'm in another country.
Okay, well, maybe... so I'll keep saying just a little bit so that Carrington can pick up where I am in the story. But basically, somebody had just sort of listed, an old Ultima game hadn't listed it for very high.
Right.
Didn't seem to know really what he had. It was very interesting because it did turn out to be, it was one of the first ones. Very very rare, very sought after. But anyway, Carrington, you can continue.
What did it sell for?
Well, that's the weird thing. Like, I don't know if did you guys because I bookmarked it or favorited it, and Paul, I don't know if you did as well. But then, so you were saying
it. So what ended up happening is it got a lot of interest and it got really high. I mean, it. I think the highest bid I saw on it was like $400 or something, which I'm sure this is totally shocking to this guy who's just found this in his attic or whatever. But the very last step was not a great step because what happened was it suddenly got lost or broken. All bids mm-hmm. canceled and probably sold to somebody who contacted him over email. So we don't know how much it went for, but it was probably over $400.
Because there's currently there's another one on eBay at the moment with a starting price of $1,000.
Well, I've
it's
seen
not
one
the
that,
same one, actually. Yeah, I did actually look, and it, you know, it's
I,
not the
I thought
identical
at first it was.
One.
I'm like, hey, this guy's just gone and relisted it, but no, it is a different one.
Well, I see one that sold an Atari 400 one, Ultima 1 Origin 1983, very rare, May 12th, $1,425.
No one cares about the Atari version.
Expensive piece of software.
Eh.
Oh, Paul, is that the highest that you know of an Apple II selling for? Is that a record?
I have no actual knowledge, but it seems pretty likely.
I think it is. I think that's the highest one I've ever heard of. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm no expert either.
My guess is that the few that are lower serial numbered than this were sort of given away more, you know, or donated. So
moving right along, let's talk more auctions. The next one is not an eBay auction, though. It's another Apple One auction. So just to kind of mention it, since these things get so much money. So here's one that's waiting for it to load here. So here's one that's coming up. It was just reported out of New York, a couple days ago. They're saying it could fetch up to $500,000. Now, having said that, I looked. I don't think you guys mentioned this on the last show, but recently another Apple One sold at that other German auction house, Brecker, where the last record was set. Anyway, so the record now is $671,000 for an Apple One that was just set just a few weeks ago. I can't see the date here, but
see, we used to mention them recently. Early on in the RCR, but then they started. It seems like another one comes for auction every week. There's only 50 of these things in the world, but they seem to auction all 50 of them every year.
Well, they're all coming out now,
up.
Right? Because people want to make the money. So anyway, just to mention, there's another one coming up, and
of course there is.
It's going to start at $300,000. They're expecting at least $500,000. Yeah, who knows? Maybe it could be a new record. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to get to, when is it? Where is it? I should have looked.
Every Wednesday.
Who cares that much, I guess. If you're really interested, just go to the show notes and go take a look. I think it's at Christie's, and I don't see the date, but soon. Go check it out.
Introducing Macintosh. It does all the things you'd expect a business computer to do. It does a lot of things you wouldn't expect a business computer to do. And it does some things no other business computer has ever done before. Of course, to do all this, you will have to learn to do this. Macintosh from Apple.
Look who's entered the personal computer game now.
Can I get in on it?
Go ahead. Introducing the AT&T Personal Computer for Business. It's fast and flexible, runs most business software, and has a high-resolution screen for superb graphics. In short, everything you need to put your business ahead of the game.
Your move.
The AT&T Personal Computer. For the dealer nearest you, call 1-800-247-1212.
So, all right. So having done all that, we are going to move along in our big shoe to what?
It's just eBay auctions all the time.
Yeah. Well, before we get into our auctions, we're going to do the retro computing gift idea, and so that this was my turn, and I picked. I'm going to actually highlight two different ones, but I picked a poster, and it's from Pop Chart Lab. So popchartlab.com. It's called The Evolution of Video Game Controllers, and it is $36. And these are like original prints, and they're signed by the artists too. And I've heard good things. James and John from the Retro Matcast, or at least James, I guess, has purchased us on the show notes. You'll see the insanely great history of Apple, another print that they do. And so he owns that one. I've heard great things about it. So there you go. They're printed on really high quality paper.
Cool.
I like the Apple one too, but this video game controller I kind of really like.
Yeah, these are large, 27 by 39 inches.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if it was professionally framed.
And I think this company, they just started framing. Of course, you could have it framed, but I believe that's something they're advertising that they do. I'm trying to look, what is the very first controllers? They're showing the controller for Space War, and then Tennis for Two, and then the Magnavox Odyssey, and of course it goes from there. Coleco Telstar.
This No, that is not connected to anything sitting in the middle of the picture.
So pretty neat. I like it. All right, now we're going to move into our eBay auctions. And I listened to the last show, guys, and I know you wanted to revisit Earl's auction about the Apple Lisa 1 that was converted to a Lisa 2.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And so I revisited it, and if you go to the link, you'll notice that it didn't sell. It got it at $565, did not meet its reserved. Then it says the seller relisted it, and if you go there, on June 15th, the seller ended it. And it says the listing was ended by the seller because there was an error in the listing.
Didn't mean to list it. Oops.
And then if you look at other, it's not currently listed. So I can only assume perhaps the person sold it offline, maybe.
These kind of eBay shenanigans like that.
Shenanigans.
And this Lisa, aside from having to... So I haven't ranted on eBay in a long time, right, guys?
Do it.
I'm due for an eBay rant.
Sure, yeah.
Aside from having to cycle through just tons of stuff that who is interested in this, nobody, then when you do find something that's interesting, it's either for crazy money, like insane money, or it isn't for insane money, but all of a sudden the item is broken or lost and no longer available. And I'm wondering, are we coming up on the end of eBay as a venue that will be useful for vintage computer enthusiasts?
Where else can I find the stuff?
Well, the question is, can you even find the stuff that you want on eBay anymore, at least not for crazy money that you don't want to pay? I'm just asking the question. I mean, I'm starting to... The utility of eBay for me, for stuff like vintage computers and their peripherals, is starting to wane because even if I do find what I'm after, then I can't afford it because whoever's selling it is just trying to get crazy money. And a lot of the time, it just doesn't sell, but they don't care because listing is either cheap or free for them, so they just relist it and wait for a sucker to come along. And so... I don't know. I find that disappointing. Other things are really cool on eBay, like I needed some feet for a 386 system that I'm restoring. Found, cheap adhesive, kind of exactly what I wanted, the rubber feet that I wanted for this thing. That kind of thing eBay's great for. But in terms of vintage computing, I don't know. I'm just not seeing as much anymore that I'm interested in.
Yeah. I think, of course, this doesn't apply as much to bidding. Right. Yeah. So if there are things that actually people will auction, then at least we know that somebody out there thought it was worth buying. Although I suppose maybe that's not even true because they may be buying speculatively. They may have seen it go for a lot more and then think, oh, this is cheap. I can flip this.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, Paul, you've bought a lot of stuff fairly recently, right?
Yeah.
So have you had good luck?
Well, I mean, I guess I was going to say probably the things that I did the best on were things that were sort of peripheral, So I saw something in an eBay listing that suggested that they might also have a thing that I'm interested in, that wasn't actually there, So there was recently an auction. It was a crazy thing. It was just like a bunch of different software all dumped together with an Apple IIe in the middle. So some Windows stuff and some, but there in that bunch there was a three still wrapped Apple II cassettes from 1979, soft tape cassettes, and I there's no way I want any of this other stuff. But I got a hold of them and said, could you part with those cassettes separately? I don't really want all this mess. And it turned out he actually had like a bunch of them. He only had put a couple in that pile. I think I ended up getting these things. Well, first of all, I got the first crack at them. But the other thing is that I think I ended up getting those and other things that had sort of happened in that same way quite a bit more economically. If you really just, there are some people out there for whom money is no object, and they will outbid you no matter how high you go. Um, so
I think that's going to continue to be the case because we're getting to the age where a lot of people who have that nostalgia connection to these computers are of the age that they have now been working for a whole bunch of years, and they're starting to accumulate extra money and go, do I want to take a trip or do I want to buy everything I ever wanted as a kid? I mean, so I think it's going to start. I think it's going to continue to drive up. There's going to be like a, in a sense, a baby boom of computer collectors, which should eventually tail off. They'll get to a point where nobody left alive gives a crap about, like, they don't have that nostalgia connection. So I don't think that they're good long-term investments, but I think prices are going to continue to rise as we have. I have pulled the trigger on some things where I can't believe what I've spent on sometimes, but I've wanted it. I've got the wherewithal. I don't give a crap. Just bring it to me. Like, it's just, you know.
Well,
and so I'm part of the problem.
It's another discussion. I think eBay, and this isn't, I know, the original thing we're talking about, but I mean, eBay is a product of the baby boom generation anyway, because we're hugely nostalgic, which I guess not all of us are baby boomers necessarily. So
and convenient.
I'm at
and
the very
you're
back, our
home,
generation.
You have a couple of beers, you're just on the net, you're like, yeah, sure. Can't believe sometimes the stuff that shows up at my house.
I think a lot of men of our age, you know, give or take some years, we're all very nostalgic about things. So
I'm nostalgic for Wednesday.
But you know, Earl, like I kind of think of eBay sort of like television, where there's a lot of crap, or how maybe reverse it. There's a lot of good stuff on television, but there's way more crap. There's way more garbage, you know, that you have to sift through, and you know, to get to the good stuff or the good people, if you will, the eBay sellers or. So there's just more. It's compounded how much more nonsense garbage there is on eBay than the other was.
I guess I'd agree with that.
Is that a good analogy?
Yeah. Yeah, that is good.
I mean, really, there's a lot of great television shows out there nowadays, but then there's just endless garbage. And Carrington, I'm sure you could say the same thing about movies. Again, there's a lot of great movies, and just how, I mean, my God, how many movies are made a year? What percentage are the good ones?
Yeah, but the ones that I think are good are often not the ones other people think. So what do I know? I love a good, like, Becker movie, so. Again, I'm
hey, it's
of
been a while since your last podcast, Double Take, hasn't it?
Yeah, we lost an episode because of recording issues, and so we recorded it again today, so it'll come out later.
Okay.
Just, it's so hard to redo a show once you've already done it.
Luckily, we've never had to do that.
Well, all the recording for Double Take's done at my end, so I have to, and I messed up. So,
Sherry's
computer can barely work a microphone, so can't record anything.
So, Carrington, while you're still talking, take it away. You got the first eBay auction.
Oh, I'm talking. I have stumbled upon this. I picked my eBay auction very, very last minute, so I don't know a lot about this, but it's something you don't come across much at all. It's a Mark 8 computer kit. So, I don't know if you guys know the Mark 8, but I think of it as one of the very first, in a sense, personal computers. It's marketed as I remember a Radio Electronics magazine, sort of the thing that promoted it. And
didn't it just slightly predate the Altair 8800?
Yeah, like in a sense, it would have a case for like being the first personal computer. Like it's lots of different things you could make the case for, but this is one of the ones, and it was sold as like $5 plans or a very rare like $50 kit. And I'm not sure if this is one of those original kits or somebody who's put together.
Yeah, that's what
a
I was.
Kit. I'm assuming that this is somebody who's put together a Mark 8 do-it-yourself kit, not an actual kit from 1970, whatever.
I'm pretty certain these are reproduction boards.
Yeah, I think so. It must be, because I was like, Mark 8 kit, what? This is all looking very clean for something from 1974. But it caught my eye because of the stuff that's been in the news lately, because of the show topic of the, you know, do you want originals versus replicas? So it's one of those things where I suspect, I mean, I've never seen an original Mark 8 ever, kit or otherwise. So I assume that this must be just somebody putting together the bits. I don't know
at that price, though.
Well, that's the thing. I was thinking I should be able to put together these bits on my own for less expensive than that, other than I think the weird, what is it, the static memory? What does it use? Oh, yeah, it says in the listing, MM1101A static memory. So some of the parts are really hard to come by. But in part value, it shouldn't add up to $2,500. So I don't know.
Or choose the boards, right? Trying to... because you have to have those boards have to be made.
Right. So I don't, like. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much the listing doesn't say much at all. It just says here's a kit. So and I picked it very last minute, but I was excited by it, and it's something I would like to have for $25, or maybe the original $50 purchase price. I wouldn't drop $2,500 on it, but if you're interested in that mid-1970s computers, there's not a lot of those, then here's a chance for you to pick up a Mark 8.
I'm trying to find out who made the kit some years ago. I'll put this link in the show notes. So the Mark 8 was designed by John Titus, and it was announced in the July 74 issue of Radio Electronics.
Great.
So 6 months ahead of the Altair. And Earl, what you're saying, and I think the correct way to refer to the Altair is it's the first complete commercially successful personal computer, mass produced.
Mm-hmm.
Commercially successful personal computer.
Link in the show notes. There's a nice memoir. I'll make sure we put the link in there. Dean Nichols. No, not Dean Nichols.
Oh, I see that, yeah.
In my name because of Canada's Best Thing. Terry Ritter. So he has a modern online blog, basically he calls it a memoir, of building the Mark 8 in 1974. And so that's the main reason I picked this, is so that we could link to that blog. And it's pretty cool. It's called a Mark 8 Experience. And it's a really interesting page, and with lots of photos, and talks about what it was like in 1974 to obtain and build one of these.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move along to... So Earl, go ahead with yours.
So, shameless plug, you guys might have heard I recently started a new podcast on programming vintage computers, Next Without Four. So as I'm looking around for things like auction stuff, that kind of influences me. I mean, I tend to look at old vintage languages, and I came across this IBM C compiler, and I had never come across this before, C/2 development language. So, and it wasn't easy to find information on what this is. It turns out it's just a C compiler, but the day and age that IBM released this, I remember the /2 mania. You know, everything was something /2.
Yeah, for OS2, yeah.
PS2, OS2, so now you got C2 to program on OS2 with your PS2.
Oh, is that what this is? So this is like a C compiler for OS2?
Yeah, either for OS2 or for DOS, it turns out. So, and, you know, I like that it's in the original IBM binder. It looks like it's in good shape, and it's got all the disks and that kind of thing. And I'm just fascinated by these old programming languages. I wouldn't be surprised, although I don't know this. Again, I tried to research this for the podcast to figure out what the origin of this was and what it morphed to. I wouldn't be surprised if it was actually developed by Microsoft, because some of those IBM languages were just OEMs of Microsoft-developed language compilers. But don't know much about this other than it looks pretty cool. And if you want to program in C like it's the late 80s, then this is what you need.
I do want to.
Who doesn't?
Well, I recently got C65. I can't remember what the number is. CC60, the cross-compiler, CC65. Mm-hmm. I recently got that working. I think we discussed it last show. So I can now pump out A2 disk images with compiled Apple II software on it using my Mac, and it's just a great experience. So still loving that.
Yeah, and in fact, we had a couple of comments in our emails from both Michael and Quinn on CC65, excited that we had brought it up, and that would, you know, they'd like to hear more if we get the chance.
I don't know what I'm moving along.
Yep. Later. More later.
Later, man.
It's definitely something that I'd like to try, getting CC65 running, although I'd never used C all that much, so maybe that's not going to be that helpful. It was actually sort of hard to find on eBay.
And this is in Earl's backyard. Earl, where is it? Yeah, it's in Portland.
Oh, how about that? Yeah, so I was just sort of thinking a little bit about space and you know, completeness and things like that, and projects.
Are you a philosopher?
We have what I picked here was I'm pointing at my screen. what I picked was a Compaq Portable 3. It's I'm not sure if you're familiar with these things. There was a sort of a series of compact computers that sort of look like sewing machines back, you know, that when they're closed up and they sort of got smaller and smaller. So the compact
we call them the lunch boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As I say, because the earlier ones, like Osborne's, they called luggables, and these are still reasonably heavy, but yeah, that was kind of the term people used, lunchbox.
Is that where the word lunchables comes from?
Yeah.
No doubt.
Lunchable computing.
But so this one, I kind of like this one because it is sort of excessively small. You know, even the portable 2 is kind of big compared to this. This is pretty small, and it has a sort of a neat little amber screen that comes out. You know, sort of if you look at the auction, that's got a sort of a mechanical. It's just sort of a neat design.
Plasma too, which is neat.
Yeah. And they say that this screen doesn't have any dead spots on it. I have a portable 3 that has a line through it, you know, that on the screen, which is kind of annoying. So it doesn't work entirely. So it qualifies as a project, but it looks like it's salvageable. And it's cheaper than there are a couple of others that are on eBay. I pointed to this one just because it's actually sort of like reasonable kind of cost. So it looks like everything's working. The thing that isn't working is it gives a keyboard error when it starts up. And I think all of these portables had this keyboard cable that I'm not sure exactly what the material was on it, but there's something that just crumbles after a certain amount of years. And you can't on this one in the auction, you can't actually see any of the material left. It's all just the blue, you know, casing that's underneath. But
that
I have a couple
be a
of
pretty
these.
Easy fix.
You'd think that's yeah. That was my hope.
Yeah.
I've had one of those before. I recently just gave it away to someone at my group, and the same thing with the keyboard. That one, the one in this auction, is like completely off. But it starts cracking and breaking at both ends. You know, next to the keyboard, next to the computer, then it just comes all off. So I guess it maybe just dries out, and becomes brittle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my guess, and it is.
Same thing happened to me, so I don't.
It's crumbling on both ends.
Right out, I became brittle. I'm crumbling at both ends. Definitely at both.
Yeah. So. I think computers.
Yeah, it's a neat style, and it's a possible project. So.
I think they, you know, compared to their earlier portables, weren't they kind of more expensive, too? Than the portable 1 and 2, I kind of think so. They got a little more expensive.
Don't know. I'm not sure.
I want to think that, you know, this machine here is probably from, you know, top of my head, maybe 87 or something like that.
As per the auction title.
Oh, I wasn't even looking at that. Yeah.
But good guess.
Yeah. But I believe they sold for like over $3,000, you know, in 87.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, they were expensive. We, in internet working type activities, we used them as network sniffers because you could put a couple different kinds of network card in here and then load up the proprietary software that costs gazillions of dollars. But it was nice because they were portable. We could carry them around to wherever the network problem was and diagnose it.
And Paul,
that was a bunch of information you didn't need.
No, it's interesting.
You were the listen. Did you want to mention this other item?
Oh yeah. Okay. So I put. I guess there will be a link available to people later. And I put a sort of an alternative link in here that I wanted to mention. This is an auction that has ended, and it's not a vintage computer. So, it is something that has been relisted a bunch of times. I got. I'm not sure if it was from the same seller, but I did get one of these a while ago, and it seemed like a good idea. It's called Open House H650, and what it is it's a little private branch exchange for your. It's like a. It basically has like 31 phone lines or something like that that go out into this little box, so that it provides a dial tone. You can dial from one extension to another, and so if you had two phones, you could plug it into this thing, The reason it's interesting to me, and I still mean to set it up in here somewhere, is that it means I can plug the two modems into it. I can plug a modem from one computer and have it call another computer in my office, and it can still have a dial tone. It can still do all of the things that the modem is expecting to have.
That's a sweet idea. I never thought of using a PBX for that, but of course, yeah, you could.
Mm-hmm. So
Cool.
It's not listed right now. Something like Asterix for that Linux PBX software. But the thing that always stymied me was the POTS interface cards were so expensive. The things that you needed to actually plug a standard telephone line into the computer.
Right, and this, I think, I forget now what it was. I had it up a minute ago. $35 or something. It's quite reasonable. And again, it's ended, but it has a history of being relisted, so I suspect it will reappear.
That's sweet. That's anyway. A great idea. Good tip. Nice.
Yep, thanks.
Nice choice. Yeah, it was $35. I'm going to watch for it because it really excites me as an idea. That's pretty fabulous.
Okay, so last is my auction pick, and do you say it that way? I think so. Pocket PC. It's spelled POQET, and it's
you
pretty.
You love your little portable computers, don't you?
Yeah, and like talking about space too. You know, that was I moved into collecting some years ago. Not that I don't still acquire here and there a large computer, but like this one. But yeah, this is very small. But what's kind of neat, I didn't realize it, but actually, I'm sitting here talking. Let me get over to the auction. I have a Wikipedia article up. So I looked it up real quick. I didn't realize that it predated both the HP 95LX and the Atari portfolio. So that's what it's very similar to. It's a small...
This came after those. Funny.
Sub-notebook. So basically, its significance is a handheld sub-notebook that is a true PC compatible. It runs MS-DOS. And... I don't know if it says here, a big deal at that time would have been probably that it could run Lotus 1-2-3 or something along those lines. But it's just an interesting, neat little computer. I kind of like its form factor and the way the keyboard is real flat with the keys. I don't know if that makes it easier to use. It's just a nice looking little machine. It's actually up to $102 right now with 2 days left. So that's surprising that it's getting that much money. So I guess maybe they're fairly rare. I really just kind of stumbled on this, but I thought it was interesting.
Well, I guess no Canadians have bid on it because he won't ship to us.
Actually, really?
Looks like it's gotten a lot of interest, except that only from two people. One person put in a very high bid, and then another person keeps increasing by like $2 to try to see test where it is.
Oh, sometimes that's somebody who's intentionally running it up because you can bid up in small increments, and you wait till the next suggested one isn't a full jump, and then you've bid up the other person all the way. Yeah, sometimes that's done by somebody who's like working for the dude who's bid on it. Yeah, I'm not saying that's happening here. Maybe there's nothing shifty, but still, funny for it's also quite a lot for something that's not necessarily even working. Doesn't say that it's working. Doesn't show it working.
Oh, you're right.
It might be non-functional. Show it.
That stinks. I like the keys, though. Again, I don't know if they work very well, but what do you think? I like how it's just kind of
looks
flat.
Cool.
It's like a tray of keys.
Mm-hmm. It's like a tray of keys. I think that was his marketing slogan at the time.
Well, that's it, guys. How are we doing? It's we've been, a little over an hour? Not too bad still. You know, there's four of us this time.
It's been less time for me because I dropped out for a while.
Well, we start a little late. I think we're actually doing really good.
Do you got any closing shots, Carrington?
I got nothing. Too much work. I have been crazy busy. I've only got 2 weeks left of crazy, insane busyness. That was supposed to actually end like a week ago, so it's been extended. But in 2 weeks, my life will be my own.
Because a lot of traveling or just work?
Just work. Okay. Too many contracts, too many businesses, just things are bonkers. Just insane. I have no life outside of work and this. So, but 2 more weeks, and then I'll be free, and then like Kansas Fest, and it's going to be awesome.
Cool.
Yeah.
Who's next? Earl, how about you?
So me. We've been doing a series of programming languages in the local Commodore Club, and I started a series on something called Blazon 4th. It was a 4th that was released for free, actually, back in the day, still around today, and a real fun language to play with. It's a pretty full 4th implementation. It also has some words in the language for the Commodore-specific features. And so we did kind of a classroom environment where everybody loaded it up, and we went through and played with a few different things, and people were following along. We're having fun. We're going to do probably 2 or 3 more sessions before we finish up on that program. So that was cool. Also, this morning I recorded the first episode of Chicken Lips Radio. So
excellent.
That should come out sometime tonight or tomorrow after I do the post-production work and all that. Having fun, we're using a 386 computer. Talked about that a little bit on the last show. The real-time clock and the battery are all in this one kind of chip enclosure, so I had to file through to get to the pins and solder some stuff, but that all worked out okay, and now it's working, and I got DOS and DBase and some other stuff loaded up on that 386, and it's a lot of fun. And family-wise, I mentioned before the show started, my son's away at a boot camp for search and rescue, and he's been gone for a week. It's starting to get, starting to get some anxiety here. I'm missing him. So he comes back on Wednesday, and I'll be good.
He'll be prepared to go find himself, though.
He will, yes. He can find me if I get lost.
So, Paul, how about you? What are you up to these days?
Oh,
you got a podcast bug now?
No.
Run out and start a podcast?
I think it would be fun, but yeah, no. I think I'm kind of in the too much work camp. Also, the I have been doing a little bit of since I haven't had time to actually do any kind of extended projects. I've been doing things like scanning, and I did those old cassettes I mentioned. I scanned them and image took the audio off the tapes and loaded them up in the emulator, and it's been kind of fun doing some of that stuff. I probably am going to try to think of some kind of retro challenge project. That's about it. But
some of those scans that you uploaded were really exciting for me, Paul. I appreciate it.
Oh yes, right. I found the Dr. Dobbs. Mm-hmm. Ones. Yes, I still have one left to go. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was really great reading.
And then for me, so I put in the show notes. Well, they won't be in the notes here for the show, but my focus is getting back on the Stan Veit audiobook podcast, which I don't know when I did the last one. I've only done 4 chapters, and I've always been determined to get back to doing this. So I'm refocusing myself on that. So I want to get another chapter out and try to get on a good schedule of getting. I want to do the whole book. So
how many chapters are there?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, but I'm going to guess 18, maybe something like that. 15, mm-hmm. somewhere around there. So the thing is, that was one of the first things I started in 2006, and I think at least now I'm a whole lot more comfortable behind the microphone. I still get kind of tongue-tied and. Here I don't worry about it so much, but in doing that book, I want it to be just right. But of course, I can edit it, so I get a little more uptight and trying to, make it just right and everything. But I think I'm better equipped to do it now, and maybe even be slightly less concerned with it being perfect. Just I want it to be good. It doesn't have to necessarily be perfect. Mm-hmm. So I just need to start doing them. So anyway, so that was my comment. Is I want to on that. It's a great book. And you cannot get it anywhere. And I've always gotten nothing but really positive feedback on the ones I've done. The next chapter is Apple, too. So there's always been a couple of good times here. I could have gotten that done and it didn't happen. So, all right, so we're going to close it out. And let's see here. Our next show is 2 weeks from today, so that's July 7th at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. And unfortunately, Earl's not going to be with us. I think we might have mentioned that, but just to reiterate, so Earl, you're going to be in Japan.
I am. Yep, I'm going to the land of the rising sun.
But your armed neighbors will be watching your home, right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, we're not all going. It's just my son and I that are getting in there. So.
And I hope you have a good trip, and try to tweet and do some ad stuff at least.
Oh, yeah. I will have a tablet with me. So I'll try and be conspicuously online.
Tweet some pics, especially if you run into any interesting vintage Japanese stuff.
Oh, that would be so cool. I have no idea where one would bump into that kind of stuff. But if it's there, that would be fun to find.
So as usual, you're going to find show notes for today's show at our website at rcrpodcast.com. You can join us in the forums at vintage-computer.com/VCF. VC forum. So that's where we use that as our forum. We're at RCR Podcast on Twitter. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we don't get a lot of feedback, so please send some feedback. Rate us on iTunes. Always try to get people to send us audio. That'd be great. We'd love to include it in the show, in the audio show anyway. So thanks for joining us, everyone. Was there any comments? Anybody happen to looking at the...
The main comment we got before I got booted from YouTube was that, boy, the videos are hard to find now. So...
For the show?
The structure has just changed, and nobody can find the live feed at the moment.
Yep, it's the open Googleites that I'm always talking about that just shift things around just to tick us off.
I mean, even if you just go to our page or whatever?
I went to it. Well, I went to our page, and it doesn't show in the top feed. It went over on the right-hand side, and I found a small link, and it seems that people are having difficulty finding the show at the moment. I'm sure once it wraps up, it'll go into our live feed, but we might have to post a thing soon about how to find these as they're streaming versus after they're wrapped. Once it's wrapped, it'll be very easy to find.
All right, so you know, anyone, we appreciate that feedback. If you stumbled on some really easy way, I found it this way, let us know. So anyway, until next time, we'll see you next time. Retro Compute.